Hello and welcome to Meet the Education Researcher. This is a podcast from the Faculty of Education, Monash University in Melbourne, Australia.
Hello and welcome back. Today we're talking about the future of academic education research, and I'm joined by Professor Sally Power from Cardiff University. And Sally's discussing her recent paper in the British Journal of Education Studies titled Confronting the Coming Crisis in Education Research. And in this paper, Sally takes Mike Savage's and Roger Burrow's famous paper from 2007, The Coming Crisis of Empirical Sociology, and applies it to the state of academic education research in the 2020s. So we talk about how academic education research is becoming increasingly irrelevant to policy and professional audiences, how our trusted empirical approaches seem to be no longer fit for purpose, but also how future forms of education research might be reinvigorated through a new politics of method. These are challenging conversations and there are no easy answers, but this is certainly something that needs to be talked about much more often by education researchers as all fields of research across the humanities and social science come under increasing threat. So for all of us working in the field of education research, I hope that Sally's arguments provide plenty of food for thought, ongoing discussion, and ultimately inspiration for future change. It seems to me, ever since I started in the mid-90s, and I'm sure since you started a bit before then, there's always been a crisis in education research. To what extent do we have a specific crisis now? And what are the specific problems that feel different this time around to, say, the 1990s and Tooley or the 1980s?
I think you're right. There's always been a crisis in education research. But I think the difference between this crisis and previous and ongoing crises is that to some extent, these are caused by internal dilemmas and rifts within the field as well as external pressures. So certainly in the 90s and onwards, there was whole debates about the extent to which policymakers didn't like the research or whether research selectivity exercises distorted the process. So there have been always concerns, but it seems to me that the nature of the concerns now are more to do with the potential redundancy of the research itself and the way in which research, particularly in the UK and probably even more so in Australia, is dominated by a particular obsession with what we call the cultural turn.
Yeah, and you talk about the redundancy of our work, which is a really nice way of putting it. And in your paper, you take Savage and Burrow's idea, The Coming Crisis of Sociology, and spin it onto education research. And your main concern is that we no longer can lay claim to specialist expertise when it comes to analysing education, which stuffs us up a little bit. And there's a few points in the papers that I just wanted to kind of go through very quickly. The first thing is, in terms of this redundancy of our work, is in comparison to the data that's just generated across education systems and even within individual education institutions. I mean, can you give us some examples from the UK that you're seeing there about this data outflanking education research?
I mean, I probably want to make a distinction between administrative data and transactional data. So there's a huge amount of administrative data in schools that is collected on attainment, at progress at different points, and not just on performance indicators, but on students' feelings. Schools regularly undertake surveys, particularly of older pupils, about how they're feeling, about their mental health. And there is also transactional data. So I'll give you an example that we did recently in our research unit, is that during COVID, there were some concerns about the extent to which young people were accessing learning resources online. Now, you could do, and we did, we actually asked students in surveys and we got data, but far more reliable data was transactional data we got of students actually login details, which was the actual what actually happened rather than what students reported they were doing. So I kind of think there are lots of things that transactional and administrative data don't collect. So I'm not saying it replaces it. But what education researchers used to do in terms of measuring attainment, looking at attainment gaps, performance gaps, schools do that now.
Yeah.
As I think I say in the paper, I'm a governor of two institutions. And I think 20 years ago, they might have asked, for my input. And I don't really have anything to say anymore because they do it all themselves, probably much better than I do.
No, that was a great bit in the paper where you say you have nothing to add in the meetings. No one looks at it. In a way, is this our fault? We spent the 1990s and the 2000s pushing for evidence-based practice and teachers as researchers, MEDs, EdDs. we can't really blame educators for kind of taking research on themselves.
No, I think that's right. You could argue that this is actually evidence of the huge success of the education research community, of instilling the importance of evidence, of looking at issues to do with equity. I mean, in some extent, it's a huge success story. But whether it makes us redundant is another issue.
Yeah, and given that you and I are still employed by universities, we don't want to be redundant yet. I mean, the second point you make is how academic researchers are no longer have this kind of privileged unveiling of hidden stories or marginalised voices and perspectives, which I think was a really, and particularly from the UK, again, you gave this idea of really influential TV documentaries, for example, on the hidden life of classrooms.
Yes.
I mean, in what ways have these news reports kind of usurped the role of academic researchers in setting agendas?
Well, I think it's probably a whole range of factors that have contributed to it. You know, ever since the 70s and 80s, things like fly-on-the-wall documentaries have taken out the role of the kind of specialist ethnographer or sociologist looking at undiscovered communities. And that's just extended into the classroom. So that people have a much better idea of classrooms and what goes on in them. I think also with the rise of social media, there are far more narratives, personal narratives, about injustices or experiences that young people face in schools, which before probably researchers might have reported. And concepts like lived experience, lived expertise are widespread. So the voice of the individual is just far more present and prevalent than it was. I also think to some extent the research community, rightly or wrongly, has contributed to our lack of success in this area. I mean, I don't know when the last time you tried to put an ethics application in, but it would be I would not be able to do the kind of research I did for my own PhD anymore. We are so hidebound by our respect for people owning their own data, for anonymity, that actually you could never do anything covert or in any way, which sometimes you need to do. Also, I just think journalists have a very different code of ethics, and their responsibility is to uncover and expose things that are going wrong. Social science researchers have a very different code of ethics, so that we're working in terms of different criteria that really handicaps us.
And you point in the paper to, you know, Willis and Learning to Labour. And I'm just wondering when the last study like that was that really captures the kind of public imagination. It probably was Willis and Learning to Labour.
It probably was. It probably was. And he probably wouldn't have been able to do that study now.
To what extent does our work still have value? I mean, for sure, journalists and documentaries are going to go over certain agendas and marginalised voices. But you know, Michael Apple still talks about education researchers acting as critical secretaries. If our work is informing these media reports, at least that's something. So, I mean, I guess we are looking for more than just what journalists are looking for.
I think that is true. And there are lots of things. I mean, again, we're doing research at the moment on school exclusions. And so we have done some very interesting research, again, it's self-reported by students, about how often they're removed from the classroom because of their behaviour. And it's a huge widespread practice that it's never going to be picked up in other forms of data.
Yeah.
Now, by talking about that, we're now talking about policymakers, and they may begin, you know, to ask schools to record those kind of instances. So I think we still have value, but I think we've lost that privileged space that we had.
No, we are kind of chasing our tails. I mean, the third point you make in the paper is that the tools that we rely upon, these self-report tools or even observational tools, are increasingly unviable. The survey, you know, the in-depth interview. Actually spending time in schools, as you said, takes up a lot of school time. It's very difficult to do ethics-wise. It does increasingly feel like we can't do research in schools. I mean, do you think empirical academic education research is now unviable?
I have to say, I think it probably is. I think it's been particularly exacerbated since COVID. I mean, it was hard enough before, but now schools are still struggling to get back to normal. And so the last thing they want is a researcher asking for surveys. We've got survey fatigue.
Yeah.
You know, children and young people and teachers are asked about things all the time. You can't walk past a shop being asked to review what it was like. So I kind of think we have real survey fatigue. And also I increasingly worry about the validity of the data that we do get. I mean, I worry about the validity of what I say if there's only 20% of respondents, which is actually now considered a fairly acceptable response rate.
5% is fairly acceptable these days, I'm afraid. I mean, the fourth point in the paper as well, I think, is, as you mentioned, this cultural turn that particularly seems to have taken place in the UK.
Yeah, I mean, clearly, like all of these distinctions, it's very crude, but I still think it's meaningful. So in the 70s, 80s, actually even in the 60s, the kind of educational research that was dominant was what I'd call political arithmetic, where you simply measured things and you found out how successful policies were. It was, in some extent, political arithmetic. It was about counting things. With the rise of, often it's seen as the new directions of sociology of education, we started worrying about the very categories that we were using, and we began to deconstruct the things that we were doing. Really interesting, there's two interesting examples I'm going to give you. One is in relation to gender. So in the political arithmetic, you just measure how boys and girls get on. You look at the attainment gap in terms of gender. In the cultural turn, you find the gender categories problematic. The actual binary division is itself seen as a form of injustice. So you actually begin to deconstruct the very categories that political arithmetic use. And similarly with things like literacy, you know, you used to just, you know, say whether people's reading ability, and now you don't just read, you perform reading tasks. So it's a kind of shift to the, I suppose, the cultural dimension of learning and the way in which social categories themselves create particular realities or injustices. A really interesting example is the idea of compensatory education. We had a big move in the 60s and 70s for things like educational priority areas, where money was put into poor schools in order to try and address some of the problems of poverty created. And that was seen then as itself as a form of injustice, because it ensured that poor communities were seen as somehow deficit. They were deficit. Mm. So that actually compensatory education, instead of being a good thing, was seen as a bad thing. So the whole politics of what you could do with your data shifted.
And lots of people would argue these are very necessary shifts, and theoretically it's very interesting to write these papers, etc. But you make the argument that this kind of limits the usefulness of this research.
Yeah, nearly all my papers were in the cultural turn. I've done some, so I mean, it's much criticism of my own. And I would say it's certainly dominant within Australia, and probably far more so than in the UK, the cultural turn. I don't know why the UK and Australia are so enraptured by the cultural turn. It might be to do with the socialization of researchers. It might be to do with the fact that, and again, you'd need to do more research on this, the extent to which education researchers in the UK and potentially Australia are primarily teachers who've moved into the field rather than being trained as specialist education researchers. And that therefore particular kinds of methods have particular appeal. I don't know, but it is very marked. It's not an inevitable state of the field.
No. And that brings us on to the kind of the crux of the paper. What do we do? And one of the obvious things we could do, as you say in the paper, is, you know, set about reviving the political arithmetic tradition, get everyone kind of empirically based and quantitative based. But you've, from what I can see from the outside, you have recently tried to inject quant into education schools, and it hasn't necessarily worked.
Yes, exactly. And there have been a number of attempts to increase the number of quantitative social scientists in the UK. There's been something called Q-Step program. Before that, there's a whole number of bursaries available for PhD students that want to do quantitative methods. But it's just not made much difference. So I kind of think that maybe the simple division itself is a problematic. I mean, it just doesn't seem to work. You can't move a whole socialized field around very quickly. And actually, even if you did, there's problems within a very naive empiricist political arithmetic, as there are within a very deconstructive post-structuralist cultural turn.
Which brings us on to the kind of where you think we could be going. I mean, you also say we could take a very much more critical stance against non-academic evidence, but, you know, we're already very good at critiquing everything. But to be positive, you kind of come back to what Mike Savage and Burroughs describe as the descriptive turn. They argue that sociology should take a descriptive turn. You argue, well, actually, this is possibly something education research could do here. Could you just explain the logic here and how this call about sociology might translate into reinvigorating education research?
Well, I think I'd begin with a number of things. I begin by saying we should celebrate description. As long as I've been in the field, saying something was descriptive is seen as a criticism.
Yep.
Oh, it's merely descriptive. So I would celebrate description. And actually, really good description is an art form in itself. It's about authenticity. It's something that should not be derided. I would not socialize students into writing endless accounts which start off with things like, there's a positivist approach, and then there's a ethnological, and I want qualitative data. I think I've seen so many dissertations, I've supervised them myself, where you make students go through particular hurdles that compare different approaches in ways, and it bears no relation to what we actually do. I don't wake up in the morning and think, oh, I'm going to reject a positivist approach today. You know, it's meaningless. If I had my way, I would ask students to write their methods account without any references. I just ask them to think about what they want to do and why they want to do it. So I'd probably throw out all the methods textbooks. And I would begin to use more imaginative forms of data. We need to stop celebrating theory, and we need to really value and encourage in students' description. When I first started studying academically, the books that I really loved were some of the books from the 60s and 70s, which have got hardly any reference to theory, but they're just really, whether it's Wilmot and Young or Working for Ford, they're just really fascinating narrative accounts that have a lot of bearing. Now, obviously, as I'm saying, some of that might be redundant because we have many more insights into other people's lives than we used to. But I do think we need to do something that makes our research more meaningful.
Yeah, and Savage talks about a kind of world-making capacity, you know, and the idea of the sociological imagination and engaging wider public. They use this phrase, engaging wider publics in vistas of wonder, concern, empathy and horror. Just evocative phrases that you don't normally associate with empirical education research. I mean, how do we find this kind of, how do we open up vistas of wonder and horror and empathy and concern and everything else?
Well, I don't know. I think I'm going to leave that to the next generation of researchers. I mean, I think to some extent, if we actually confront our own potential redundancy more seriously, and rather than just be very defensive about the fact that policymakers don't like us or whatever, I think we will be forced to do things differently. Mm. I mean, I suppose the good thing is that some of these things do not. I mean, we know there's a funding crisis. There's relatively little funding for education research. So it might be that we're forced to do things in a slightly different way than we've done hitherto.
I like the idea of being creative, being imaginative, going guerrilla, doing things for very, very few dollars rather than hundreds of thousands. So, I mean, you and I are kind of nearing the end of our careers, but I mean, what do you think is going to happen? How do you think this is going to pan out? What will the next generation of education researchers be facing? Are people going to change their ways quick enough, or are we doomed to be redundant?
I don't know. I think we might have a bifurcation of the field where we have a volume of research that is almost like professional training for teacher educators, and which is some of what we have already. Because I'm not saying that's all bad, and it's useful for professional trainings, for getting people to think. So I kind of think we might see that carrying on.
The kind of what works and why.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, encouraging teachers in the classroom to think about what they're doing and how would they evaluate. So I think there will be that. But I think probably, I hate the idea that the kind of elite research, but there would be a perhaps smaller cadre of education research, a bit like in the 60s and 70s, which was experimenting and doing new things that then might be picked up by other researchers later. So we just need to be far more experimental, far less risk averse. I think journals have a lot to answer for. The number of times I send an article off and I get told that it's fine, if only I'd incorporate, you know, 20 more citations of various people. And actually, it doesn't make the article better. So I kind of think we need to stop putting these boundaries on ourselves and open up, perhaps be a bit more journalistic.
There you go. Well, that's a nice note to end on. We need to be boutique researchers and have a kind of journalistic gonzo mentality. So, I mean, it's a fascinating paper. I'd recommend everybody reads it. And thanks ever so much for taking the time to discuss it, Sally.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me to talk about it.